Boil some water in a narrow-spouted pot. Let it sit for a while. Then slowly, and I mean slowly, pour the water through a paper filter. When the coffee's ready, Oshima puts in the smallest pinch of sugar. Just for show, basically, but no cream. The best way, he insists. I make myself some Earl Grey tea. Oshima has on a shiny brown short-sleeved shirt and white linen trousers. Wiping his glasses with a freshly laundered handkerchief he pulls from his pocket, he turns to me. You don't look as though you got much sleep. There's something I'd like you to do for me, I say. Name it. I want to listen to Kafka on the Shore. Can you get hold of the record? Not the CD. If possible, I'd like to listen to the record, to hear how it originally sounded. Of course, we'd have to find a record player, too. Oshima rests his fingers on his temple and thinks. There might be an old record player in the storeroom. Can't guarantee it still works, though. We go into a small room facing the car park. There are no windows, only a skylight high up. A mess of objects from various periods are strewn around. Furniture, dishes, magazines, clothes and paintings. Some of them are obviously valuable, but some, most in fact, don't look as if they're worth much. Someday we've got to get rid of all this junk, Oshima remarks, but nobody's been brave enough to take the plunge. In the middle of the room, where time seems to have drifted to a halt, we find an old Sansui record player. Covered in a thin layer of white dust, the record player itself looks in good shape, though it must be more than 25 years since this was up-to-date audio equipment. The whole set consists of a receiver, amp, turntable, and bookshelf speakers. We also find a collection of old LPs, mostly 60s pop music, Beatles, Stones, Beach Boys, Simon and Garfunkel, Stevie Wonder. About 30 albums, all told. I take some out of their sleeves. Whoever listened to these took good care of them, because there's no trace of mould and not a scratch anywhere. There's a guitar in the storeroom as well, still with strings, plus a pile of old magazines I've never heard of, and an old-fashioned tennis racket, all like the ruins of some not-so-distant past. I imagine all this stuff belonged to Miss Saiki's boyfriend, Oshima says. As I mentioned, he used to live in this building, and they must have thrown his things down here. The record player, though, looks too recent for that. We lug the record player and records to my room. We dust it off, plug it in, connect up the player and amp and hit the switch. The little green light on the amp comes on, and the turntable begins to revolve. I check the cartridge and find it has a still decent needle, then take out the red vinyl record of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and put it on the turntable. The familiar guitar intro starts to play. The sound's much cleaner than I expected. Japan has its share of problems, Oshima says, smiling. But we sure know how to make a sound system. This thing hasn't been used in ages, but it still sounds great. We listen to the Beatles album for a while. Compared to the CD version, it sounds like different music altogether. Well, we've got something to listen to it on, Oshima concludes. But getting hold of a single of Kafka on the Shore might be a problem. That's a pretty rare item nowadays. I tell you what, I'll ask my mother. She's probably got a copy tucked away somewhere. Or at least she'll know somebody who has. I nod. Oshima raises a finger, like a teacher warning a pupil. One thing, though. Make sure you never play it when Miss Saiki's here. No matter what. Understood? I nod again. As in Casablanca, he says, and hums the opening bars of As Time Goes By. Just don't play that one song, okay? Oshima, there's something I want to ask. Does any 15-year-old girl come here? By here you mean the library? I nod. Oshima tilts his head and gives it some thought. Not as far as I know, he says, staring at me as if he's looking into the room from a window. That's a strange thing to ask. I think I saw her recently, I say. When was this? Last night. You saw a 15-year-old girl here last night?
Yeah.
What kind of girl?
I blush a bit.
just a girl, hair down to her shoulders, wearing a blue dress. Was she pretty? I nod. Could be a sexual fantasy, Ushima says and grins. The world's full of weird things. But for a healthy, heterosexual boy your age, having fantasies like that's not so strange. I remember how Ushima saw me stark naked at the cabin, and blush even more. During our lunch break, Ushima hands me a single of Kafka on the Shore in a square little sleeve. Turns out my mum did have one. 5 copies, if you can believe it. She really takes good care of things. A bit of a hoarder, but I guess we shouldn't complain. Thanks, I say. I go back to my room and take the record out of the sleeve. The record looks as if it's never been played. In the record sleeve photo, Miss Sayaki, she was 19 according to Ushima, is sitting at a piano in a recording studio. Looking straight at the camera, she's resting her chin in her hands on the music stand, her head tilted slightly to one side, a shy, unaffected smile on her face. Closed lips spread pleasantly wide, with charming lines at the corners. It doesn't look as if she's wearing any makeup. Her hair's held back by a plastic clip so it won't fall into her face, and part of her right ear's visible through the strands. Her light blue dress is short and loose-fitting, and she has a silver bracelet on her left wrist, her only accessory. A pair of slender sandals lie next to her piano stool, and her bare feet are lovely. She looks like a symbol of something. A certain time, a certain place, a certain state of mind. She's like a spirit that sprung up from a happy chance encounter. An eternal, naive innocence, never to be marred, floats around her like spores in spring. Time had come to a standstill in this photograph. It is 1969, a scene from long before I was even born. I knew from the first that the young girl who visited my room last night was Miss Sayaki. I never doubted it for a second, but just had to make sure. Compared to when she was 15, Miss Sayaki at 19 looks more grown up, more mature. If I had to compare the two, I'd say the outline of her face looks sharper, more defined in the photo. A certain anxiousness is missing from the older of the two. But otherwise, this 19-year-old and the 15-year-old I saw are nearly identical. The smile in the photo's the same one I saw last night. How she held her chin in her hands and tilted her head, also the same. And in Miss Sayaki now, the real-time Miss Sayaki, I can see the same expressions and gestures. I'm delighted that those features and her sense of the otherworldly haven't changed a bit. Even her build is almost the same. Still, there's something in this photo of the 19-year-old that the middle-aged woman I know has lost forever. You might call it an outpouring of energy. Nothing showy. It's colourless, transparent, like fresh water secretly seeping out between rocks. A kind of natural, unspoiled appeal that shoots straight to your heart. That brilliant energy seeps out of her entire being as she sits there at the piano. Just looking at that happy smile, you can trace the beautiful path that a contented heart must follow. Like a firefly's glow that persists, long after it's disappeared into the darkness. I sit on my bed for a long time, record sleeve in hand, not thinking about anything, just letting time pass by. I open my eyes, go to the window, and take a deep breath of fresh air, catching a whiff of the sea on the breeze that's come up through a pine forest. What I saw here in this room the night before was definitely Miss Sayaki at 15. The real Miss Sayaki, of course, is still alive. A 50-something woman, living a real life in the real world. Even now, she's in her room upstairs at her desk, working away. To see her, all I need to do is go out of this room and up the stairs and there she'll be. I can meet her, talk to her. but none of that changes the fact that what I saw here was her ghost. Ushima told me people can't be in two places at once. But I think it's possible. In fact, I'm sure of it. While they're still alive, people can become ghosts. And there's another important fact. I'm drawn to that ghost, attracted to her. Not to the Miss Saiki who's here right now, but to the 15-year-old who isn't. Very attracted. A feeling so strong I can't explain it. And no matter what anybody says, this is real. Maybe she doesn't really exist, but just thinking about her makes my heart, my flesh and blood, my real heart, thump like mad. These feelings are as real as the blood all over my chest that awful night. As it gets near closing time, Miss Saiki comes downstairs, her heels clicking on each step. When I see her, I tense up and can hear my heart pounding. I see the 15-year-old girl inside her. Like some small animal in hibernation, she's curled up in a hollow inside Miss Saiki asleep. Miss Saiki's asking me something, but I can't reply. I don't even know what she said. I can hear her, of course. Her words vibrate my eardrums and transmit a message to my brain that's converted into language. But there's a disconnection between words and meaning. Flustered, I blush and stammer out something stupid. Ushima intervenes and answers her question. I nod at what he's saying. Miss Saiki smiles, says goodbye to us, and leaves for home. I listen to the sound of her golf as it exits the car park, fades into the distance, and disappears. Ushima stays behind and helps me close up for the night. Have you fallen in love with somebody by any chance? He asks. You seem kind of out of it. I don't have any idea how I should respond. Ushima, I finally say. This is a pretty weird thing to ask. But do you think it's possible for someone to become a ghost while they're still alive? He stops straightening up the counter and looks at me. A very interesting question, actually. Are you asking about the human spirit in a literary sense, metaphorically, in other words? Or do you mean in actual fact? More in actual fact, I guess, I say. The assumption that ghosts really exist. Right. Ushima removes his glasses, wipes them with his handkerchief, and puts them back on. That's what's called a living spirit. I don't know about in foreign countries, but that kind of thing appears a lot in Japanese literature. The tale of Genji, for instance, is filled with living spirits. In the Heian period, or at least in its psychological realm. On occasion, people could become living spirits and travel through space to carry out whatever desires they had. Have you read Genji? I shake my head. Our library has a couple of modern translations, so it might be a good idea to read one. Anyway, an example is when Lady Rokujo, she's one of Prince Genji's lovers, becomes so consumed with jealousy over Genji's main wife, Lady Aoi, that she turns into an evil spirit that possesses her. Night after night, she attacks Lady Aoi in her bed, until she finally kills her. Lady Aoi was pregnant with Genji's child, and that news is what inspired Lady Rokujo's hatred. Genji calls in priests to exorcise the evil spirit, but to no avail. The evil spirit is impossible to resist. But the most interesting part of the story is that Lady Rokujo had no inkling that she'd become a living spirit. She'd have nightmares and wake up, only to discover that her long black hair smelled of smoke. Not having any idea what was going on, she was totally confused. In fact, the smoke came from the incense the priests lit as they prayed for Lady Aoi. Completely unaware of it, she'd been flying through space and passing down the tunnel of her subconscious into Aoi's bedroom. This is one of the most uncanny and thrilling episodes in Genji. Later, when Lady Rokujo learns what she's been doing, She regrets the sins she's committed, and shaves off her hair and renounces the world. The world of the grotesque is the darkness within us. Well before Freud and Jung shone a light on the workings of the subconscious, this correlation between darkness and our subconscious, these two forms of darkness, was obvious to people. It wasn't a metaphor, even. If you trace it back further, it wasn't even a correlation. Until Edison invented the electric light, most of the world was covered in darkness. The physical darkness outside and the inner darkness of the soul were mixed together, with no boundary separating the two. They were directly linked, like this. Oshima brings his two hands together tightly. In Murasaki Shikibu's time, living spirits were both a grotesque phenomenon and a natural condition of the human heart that was right there with them. People of that period probably couldn't conceive of these two types of darkness as separate from each other. But today things are different. The darkness in the outside world has vanished, but the darkness in our hearts remains virtually unchanged. Just like an iceberg, what we label the ego or consciousness is, for the most part, sunk in darkness. And that estrangement sometimes creates a deep contradiction or confusion within us. Around your mountain cabin. That's real darkness. Absolutely, Oshima says. Real darkness still exists there. Sometimes I go there just to experience it, Oshima says. What triggers people to become living spirits? Is it always something negative? I'm no expert, but as far as I know, yes, those living spirits all spring up out of negative emotions. Most of the extreme feelings people have tend to be at once very individual and very negative. And these living spirits arise through a kind of spontaneous generation. Sad to say, there aren't any cases of a living spirit emerging to fulfill some logical premise or bring about world peace. What about because of love? Oshima sits down and thinks it over. That's a tough one. All I can tell you is that I've never run across an example. Of course, there is that tale, The Chrysanthemum Pledge, in Tales of Moonlight and Rain. Have you read it? No, I reply. Tales of Moonlight and Rain was written in the late Edo period by a man named Ueda Akinari. It was set, however, in the earlier Warring States period, which makes Ueda's approach a bit nostalgic or retro. Anyway, in this particular story, two samurai become fast friends and pledge themselves as blood brothers. For samurai, this is very serious. Being blood brothers means they pledge their lives to each other. They live far away from one another, each serving a different lord. One writes to the other saying no matter what, he will visit when the chrysanthemums are in bloom. The other says he'll wait in that case for his arrival. But before the first one can set out on the journey, he gets mixed up in some trouble in his domain, is put under confinement, and isn't allowed to go out or to send a letter. Finally, summer is over, and autumn's upon them, the season when the chrysanthemums blossom. At this rate, he won't be able to fulfill his promise to his friend. To a samurai, nothing's more important than a promise. Honor's more important than your life. So this samurai commits harakiri, becomes a spirit, and races across the miles to visit his friend. They sit near the chrysanthemums and talk to their heart's content, and then the spirit vanishes from the face of the earth. It's a beautiful tale. But he had to die in order to become a spirit. Yes, that's right, Oshima says. It would appear that people can't become living spirits out of honor or love or friendship. To do that, they have to die. People throw away their lives for honor, love, or friendship, and only then do they turn into spirits. But when you talk about living spirits, well, that's a different story. They always seem to be motivated by evil. I mull this over. But as you said, there might be examples, Oshima continues, of people becoming living spirits out of positive feelings of love. I just haven't done much research into the matter, I'm afraid. Maybe it happens. Love can rebuild the world, they say, so everything's possible when it comes to love. Have you ever been in love? I ask. He stares at me, taken aback. What do you think? I'm not a starfish or a pepper tree. I'm a living, breathing human being. Of course I've been in love. That isn't what I mean, I say, blushing. I know, he says, and smiles at me sweetly. When Oshima leaves, I go back to my room, switch the stereo to 45 RPM, lower the needle, and listen to Kafka on the Shore, following the lyrics on the sleeve. You sit at the edge of the world. I am in a crater that's no more. Words without letters, standing in the shadow of the door. The moon shines down on a sleeping lizard. Little fish rain down from the sky. Outside the window there are soldiers, steeling themselves to die. Kafka sits in a chair by the shore, thinking of the pendulum that moves the world, it seems. When your heart is closed, the shadow of the unmoving sphinx becomes a knife that pierces your dreams. The drowning girl's fingers search for the entrance stone and more. Lifting the hem of her azure dress, she gazes at Kafka on the shore. I listen to the record 3 times. First of all, I'm wondering how a record with lyrics like this could sell more than 1 million copies. I'm not saying they're totally obscure, just kind of abstract and surreal. Not exactly catchy lyrics. But if you listen to them a few times, they begin to sound familiar. One by one, the words find a home in my heart. It's a weird feeling. Images beyond any meaning arise like cut-out figures and stand alone. Just like when I'm in the middle of a deep dream. The melody is beautiful, simple but different too. And Miss Sayaki's voice melts into it naturally. Her voice needs more power. She isn't what you'd call a professional singer. But it gently cleanses your mind, like a spring rain washing over stepping stones in a garden. She played the piano and sang. Then they added a small string section and an oboe. The recording budget must have kept the arrangement simple, but actually it's this simplicity that gives the song its appeal. 2 unusual chords appear in the refrain. The other chords in the song are nothing special, but these 2 are different. Not the kind you can work out by listening only a couple of times. At first, I felt confused. To exaggerate a little, I felt betrayed even. The total unexpectedness of the sounds shook me, unsettled me, as when a cold wind suddenly blows in through a crack. Once the refrain is over, though, that beautiful melody returns, taking you back to that original world of harmony and intimacy. No more chilly wind here. The piano plays its final note, while the strings quietly hold the last chord, the lingering sound of the oboe bringing the song to a close. Listening to it over and over, I start to get some idea why Kafka on the Shore moved so many people. The song's both direct and gentle at the same time, the product of a capable yet unselfish heart. There's a kind of miraculous feel to it, this overlap of opposites. A shy 19-year-old girl from a provincial town writes lyrics about her boyfriend far away, sits down at the piano, and sets it to music, then unhesitatingly sings her creation. She didn't write the song for others to hear, but for herself, to warm her own heart, if only a little. And her self-absorption strikes a subtle but powerful chord in her listeners' hearts. I throw together a simple dinner from things in the fridge, then put Kafka on the Shore on the turntable again. Eyes closed, I sit in the chair and try to picture the 19-year-old Miss Sayaki in the studio, playing the piano and singing. I think about the love she felt as she sang, and how mindless violence severed that love forever. The record is over. The needle lifts up and returns to its cradle. Miss Sayaki may have written the lyrics to Kafka on the Shore in this very room. The more I listen to the record, the more I'm sure that this Kafka on the Shore is the young boy in the painting on the wall. I sit at the desk, and, as she did last night, hold my chin in my hands, and gaze at the same angle at the painting right in front of me. I'm positive now this had to be where she wrote it. I see her gazing at the painting, remembering the young boy, writing the poem she then set to music. It had to have been at night, when it was pitch dark outside. I stand up, go to the painting, and examine it up close. The young man's looking off into the distance, his eyes full of a mysterious depth. In one corner of the sky, there are some sharply outlined clouds, and the largest looks sort of like a crouching sphinx. I search my memory. The sphinx was the enemy Oedipus defeated by solving the riddle, and once the monster knew it had lost, it leapt off a cliff and killed itself. Thanks to this exploit, Oedipus became king of Thebes and ended up marrying his own mother. And the name Kafka. I suspect Miss Sayaki used it since in her mind, the mysterious solitude of the boy in the picture overlapped with Kafka's fictional world. That would explain the title. A solitary soul straying beside an absurd shore. Other lines overlap with things that happened to me. The part about little fish rain down from the sky. Isn't that exactly what happened in that shopping district at home, when hundreds of sardines and mackerel rained down? The part about how the shadow becomes a knife that pierces your dreams. That could be my father's stabbing. I copy down all the lines of the song in my notebook and study them, underlining parts that particularly interest me. But in the end, it's all too suggestive, and I don't know what to make of it. Words without letters, standing in the shadow of the door. The drowning girl's fingers search for the entrance stone. Outside the window there are soldiers, steeling themselves to die. What could it mean? Were all these just coincidences? I walk to the window and look out at the garden. Darkness is just settling in on the world. I go to the reading room, sit on the sofa, and open up Tanizaki's translation of the tale of Genji. At 10, I go to bed, turn off the bedside light, and close my eyes, waiting for the 15-year-old Miss Sayaki to return to this room.
24. It was already 8 p.m. when their bus from Kobe arrived in front of Tokushima Station. "Well, Mr. Nakata, here we are. Shikoku." "What a wonderful bridge. Nakata's never seen such a huge one before." The two of them alighted from the bus and sat on a bench at the station, surveying their surroundings. "So, did you have a message from God or something?" Hoshino asked. "Telling you where you're supposed to go now? What you're supposed to do?"
"No, Nakata still has no idea."
"Great." Nakata rubbed his head deliberately with his palm for a while, as if pondering weighty matters.
"Mr. Hoshino," he finally said.
"What's up?"
"I'm sorry, but Nakata really needs to go to sleep. I'm so sleepy I feel like I could fall asleep right here."
"Wait a sec, you can't fall asleep here," Hoshino said, flustered. "Tell you what, I'll find a place where you can crash out, okay? Just hang in there for a while."
"All right. Nakata will hang on in there and try not to fall asleep."
"Good. Are you hungry?"
"No, just sleepy."
Hoshino quickly located the tourist information desk, found an inexpensive inn that included complimentary breakfast, and called to book a room. It was some distance from the station, so they hailed a taxi. As soon as they arrived, Hoshino asked the maid to lay out their futons for them. Nakata skipped taking a bath and undressed, lay down in bed, and in an instant was peacefully snoring away.
"I'll probably sleep for a long time, so don't be alarmed," he had said just before he fell asleep.
"Hey, I'm not going to bother you. Sleep as much as you want, Hoshino said, but Nakata was already lost to the world. Hoshino enjoyed a leisurely bath, went out and strolled around to get the lie of the land, then ducked inside a sushi shop for dinner and a beer. He wasn't much of a drinker, and a medium-sized bottle of beer was enough to turn his face bright red and put him in a good mood. After dinner, he played pachinko and lost 3,000 yen in an hour. His Chunichi Dragon's baseball cap drew a few stares from passers-by, and he decided he must be the only one in Tokushima wearing one. Back at the inn, he found Nakata just as he'd left him, sound asleep. The light was on in the room, but that obviously didn't bother him. "What an easy-going old boy," Hoshino concluded. He took off his cap, his lower shirt and jeans, then crawled into bed and turned out the light. But he felt worked up, and the combination of this and his new surroundings kept him from falling asleep. "Jesus," he thought, "maybe I should have found a whore and got laid." But as he listened to Nakata's tranquil, regular breathing, he was suddenly embarrassed by the thought, though he wasn't sure why. Staring at the ceiling in the dark, lying in bed in a cheap inn in a town he'd never been to before, next to a strange old guy he knew nothing about, he began to have doubts about himself. By this time of night he should have been driving back to Tokyo, now somewhere around Nagoya. He didn't dislike his job, and there was a girl in Tokyo who always made time for him if he wanted to see her. Still, on an impulse, as soon as he'd unloaded his cargo of furniture in Kobe, he'd called another driver he knew in town and asked him to take his place and drive his rig back to Tokyo. He phoned the company and managed to wangle 3 days off, and then it was off to Shikoku with Nakata. All he had with him was a small bag with a shaving kit and a change of clothes. Hoshino was at first intrigued by the resemblance between the old man and his late grandfather, but that impression had faded, and now he was more curious about Nakata himself. The things the old guy talked about, and even how he talked, were definitely strange, but in an interesting way. He had to find out where the old man was going, and what he'd end up doing when he got there. Hoshino was born into a farming family, the third of five sons. Until junior high, he was well-behaved, but after entering a trade school, he fell in with a bad crowd and started getting into trouble. The police hauled him in a few times. He was able to graduate, but couldn't find a decent job, and trouble with a girl only compounded his difficulties, so he decided to join the self-defense force. Though he was hoping to be a tank driver, he didn't make the grade, and spent most of his time driving large transport trucks. After 3 years in the SDF, he got out and found a job with a trucking company, and for the last 6 years he'd been driving for a living. This suited him. He'd always loved machines, and when he was perched high up in the cab with hands on the wheel, it was like he was in his own private little kingdom. The job's long, hard hours were tiring, but he knew he couldn't stand a regular company job, commuting to a dingy office every morning only to have a boss watch his every move like a hawk. He'd always been the feisty type who got into fights. He was skinny and on the short side, not very tough-looking, but in his case looks were deceiving. He was deceptively strong, and once he reached breaking point, a crazed look would come over him that sent most opponents scurrying for cover. He got into a lot of fights, both as a soldier and as a lorry driver, but only recently had started to understand that this win or lose never accomplished very much. At least, he thought proudly, he'd never had any serious injuries. During his wild high school days, his grandfather was always the one who'd show up at the local police station, bowing apologetically to the officers, and they'd release him into his custody. They always stopped at a restaurant on the way home, his grandfather treating him to a delicious meal. He never lectured Hoshino, even then. Not once did his parents come to get him. They were just barely scraping by, and didn't have the time or energy to worry about their no-good third son. Hoshino sometimes wondered what would have happened to him if his grandfather hadn't been there to bail him out. The old man, at least, knew he was alive and worried about him. Despite all this, he'd never once thanked his grandfather for all he'd done. He didn't know what to say, and was also too preoccupied trying to get by. His grandfather died of cancer soon after Hoshino joined the self-defense force. At the end, he got senile and didn't even recognize him. Hoshino hadn't been home once since the old man died. When Hoshino woke up at 8 the next morning, Nakata was still fast asleep, and looked as though he hadn't budged an inch all night. The volume and pace of his breathing, too, was unchanged. Hoshino went downstairs and ate breakfast with the other guests. A pretty bare-bones meal, though there were unlimited seconds on miso soup and rice.
"Will your companion be eating breakfast?"
the maid called out.
"He's still out cold. Looks like he won't be needing breakfast. If you don't mind, could you not put away the futon for a while?"
At noon, with Nakata still fast asleep, Hoshino arranged for them to stay one more night. He went out to a soba place and had chicken and egg over rice. Afterwards he strolled around for a while and wound up in a coffee shop, where he had a cup and a cigarette and flipped through a few of the comic books. When he got back to the inn, just before two, he found Nakata still hadn't woken up. Concerned, he felt the old man's forehead, but he didn't appear to have a fever. His breathing was calm and regular, and his cheeks had a healthy glow to them. He seemed perfectly fine. All he was doing was sleeping soundly, without ever even turning over in bed.
"Is he all right, sleeping this much?" the maid said when she looked in on them. "Maybe he's ill."
"He's exhausted," Hoshino explained. "Just let him sleep as much as he wants."
"Okay, but I've never seen anybody sleep so much before."
Dinner time came, and the sleep marathon continued. Hoshino went out to a curry restaurant and had an extra-large order of beef curry and a salad. After this, he went to the same pachinko place as the night before and again played for an hour. This time, though, his luck changed, and for under 1,000 yen, he won 2 cartons of Marlboros. It was 9:30 by the time he got back to the inn with his winnings, and he couldn't believe his eyes. Nakata was still asleep. Hoshino added up the hours. The old man had been sleeping for more than 24 hours. Okay, he said he'd sleep a long time, so not to worry, but this was ridiculous. Hoshino felt uncharacteristically helpless. Suppose the old guy never woke up? What the hell was he supposed to do then? "Cripes," he said, and shook his head. The next morning, though, when Hoshino woke at 7, Nakata was already awake, gazing out the window.
"Hey, Gramps, so you made it, eh?" Hoshino said, relieved.
"Yes, Nakata just woke up. I don't know how long I slept, but it must have been a long time. I feel like a new man."
"No kidding, it was a long time. You went to sleep at 9 p.m. the day before yesterday, so you were asleep something like 34 hours. You're a regular Snow White."
"Nakata's kind of hungry."
"I bet you are. You haven't had a bite in 2 days."
The two of them went downstairs to the dining room and had breakfast. Nakata amazed the maid at how much rice he packed away.
"You're as big an eater as you are a sleeper," she exclaimed. "It's like 2 days' worth of meals in one sitting."
"Yes, I have to eat a lot now."
"You're a really healthy person, aren't you?"
"Yes, Nakata is. I can't read, but I've never had a single cavity and don't need glasses. I never have to go to the doctor, either. My shoulders never get stiff, and I take a good dump every morning."
"Isn't that something?" the maid said, impressed. "By the way, what's on your schedule for today?"
"We're headed west," Nakata declared.
"West?" she mused. "That must mean you're going towards Takamatsu."
"I'm not so bright and don't know geography."
"Anyway, Gramps, why don't we go over to Takamatsu?" Hoshino chimed in. "We can work out what's next after we get there."
"All right, let's go to Takamatsu then. We'll work out what's next after we get there."
"Sort of a unique style of travelling, I must say," the maid commented.
"You got that right," Hoshino said.
Back in their room, Nakata went to the toilet, while Hoshino, still in his yukata robe, lay back on the tatami and watched the news on TV. Not a lot was happening. Police still didn't have any leads in the murder of a famous sculptor in Nakano. No clues, no witnesses. The police were searching for the man's 15-year-old son, who disappeared shortly before the murder.
"Man alive," Hoshino thought, "a 15-year-old kid. Why is it that these days it's always 15-year-olds who are involved in all these violent incidents?
Of course, when he was 15 himself, he'd stolen a motorcycle from a car park and went for a joyride, without, mind you, a license, so he had no right to complain. Not that you could compare borrowing a motorcycle and slicing your dad into sashimi. It was only luck, maybe, that had kept him from stabbing his own father, because he'd certainly taken his share of beatings. The news was just winding up when Nakata emerged from the bathroom.
"Mr. Hoshino, may I ask you something?"
"What's up?"
"Does your back hurt at all?"
"Yeah, it's an occupational hazard, I guess. Every lorry driver I know has back problems, just as pitchers all have sore shoulders. Why do you ask?"
"When I saw your back, I thought maybe you had that problem."
"Huh?
Do you mind if Nakata touches your back?"
"Be my guest." Hoshino was lying face down, and Nakata straddled him. He put his hands just above the backbone and held them there. All the while, Hoshino was watching some chat show featuring all the latest celebrity gossip. A famous actress had just got engaged to a not-so-famous young novelist. Hoshino didn't care, but there wasn't anything else on. Apparently, the actress's income was 10 times that of the novelist, who wasn't even particularly handsome or very intelligent-looking. Hoshino found the whole thing suspect. "That marriage won't last, I can tell you that. There's got to be some kind of misunderstanding going on here."
"Mr. Hoshino, your bones are out of line a bit."
"Not surprising, what with the out-of-line kind of life I've led," Hoshino replied and yawned.
"It's going to cause all sorts of problems if you don't do something about it."
"You think?"
"You'll get headaches, you won't be able to take a good dump, and then your back will go out on you."
"Well, that can't be good."
"This will hurt a little. Do you mind?"
"No, go right ahead."
"Honestly speaking, it's going to hurt a lot."
"Look, Gramps, I've been beaten up my whole life, at home, at school, in the SDF, but I survived. Not to brag or anything, but the days I haven't been hit I could count on both hands. So I'm not worried that something might hurt a little. Hot or tickly, sweet or spicy, bring it on." Nakata squinted, concentrating, carefully making sure he had his two thumbs just where he wanted them. Once they were positioned just right, he ever so slowly increased the pressure, gauging Hoshino's reaction. He breathed in deeply, then let out a clipped cry like some winter bird's squawk, and pressed down with all his might on the area between muscle and backbone. The pain Hoshino felt at that instant was awful, irrationally so. A huge flash of light went off in his brain and everything went white. He stopped breathing. It felt as if he had been thrown from the top of a tall tower into the depths of hell. He couldn't even manage a scream, so hideous was the pain. All thoughts had burned up and shot away. It was like his body had been shattered into pieces. Even death couldn't be this awful, he felt. He tried to open his eyes, but couldn't. He just lay there, helpless, face down on the tatami, drooling, tears streaming down his face. He must have endured this for some 30 seconds or so. Eventually, he was able to breathe again, and staggered as he sat up. The tatami wavered before him like the sea in a storm.
"I'm sure it was painful."
Hoshino shook his head a few times, as if checking to be sure that he was still alive.
"Pain doesn't begin to describe it. Imagine getting skinned alive, skewered, ground to a powder, then run over by a herd of angry bulls. What the hell did you do to me?"
"I put your bones back in the right position. You should be fine for the time being. Your back won't ache, and I guarantee you'll take good dumps."
As predicted, when the pain receded, like a tide going out, his back did feel better. The usual heavy, sluggish feeling had vanished. The area around his temples felt much better, and he could breathe more easily. And sure enough, he felt like going to the toilet. Yeah, I guess certain parts do feel better.
"The problem was all in the spine," Nakata said.
"But damn, did that hurt,"
Hoshino said, and sighed. The two of them took the JR express train from Tokushima Station, bound for Takamatsu. Hoshino paid for everything, the inn and the train fare. Nakata insisted on paying his share, but Hoshino wouldn't hear of it.
I'll pay now and we can settle up later. I don't like it when men go all to pieces over money, okay?
All right. Nakata doesn't understand money very well, so I'll do as you say, Nakata said.
I gotta tell you, though, I feel great, thanks to that shiatsu you did on me. So at least let me pay you back for it, okay? I haven't felt this good in I don't know how long. I feel like a new man.
That's wonderful. Nakata doesn't know what shiatsu means, but I do know how important the bones are.
I'm not sure what you call it either. Shiatsu, bone setting, chiropractic, but whatever it is, you've really got a talent for it. You could make a lot of money doing this. You could make a bundle just doing all my lorry driver mates.
As soon as I saw your back, I could tell the bones were out of line. When I see something out of line, I like to set it right. I made furniture for a long time, and whenever I saw something crooked, I just had to straighten it out. That's just how Nakata is. But this was the first time I straightened out bones.
I guess you're a natural, Hoshino said, impressed.
Nakata used to be able to speak to cats.
No kidding.
But not so long ago I couldn't talk to them any more. It must be Johnny Walker's fault.
I see.
I'm stupid, so I don't understand difficult things, and there have been so many difficult things happening lately. Fish and leeches falling from the sky, for instance.
Really?
But I'm glad I could make your back better. If you feel good, then Nakata feels good.
I'm really happy too, Hoshino said.
That's good. Now that you mention those leeches, yes, Nakata remembers that very well.
Did you have something to do with that?
Nakata thought about it for a while, a rare occurrence.
I don't really know myself. All I know is when I opened my umbrella, it started to rain leeches.
What you know?
The worst thing of all is killing other people, Nakata said, and gave a decisive nod.
Absolutely. Killing is bad, for sure.
That's right, Nakata said again, nodding vigorously.
The two of them got out at Takamatsu Station, then slipped inside a noodle place near the station and had udon for lunch. Outside the restaurant window, there were several large cranes on the docks, covered with seagulls. Nakata methodically enjoyed each and every noodle.
This udon is delicious, he said.
Glad you like it, Hoshino said. So what do you think? Is this spot okay?
Yes, Nakata thinks it will do.
So we got the right spot picked out. Now what are you going to do?
I've got to find the entrance stone.
Entrance stone?
That's right.
Hoshino said. I bet there's a long story behind that.
Nakata tilted his bowl and drained the last drop of soup.
Yes, it is a long story. But it's so long I don't understand it myself. Once we get there, though, Nakata thinks we'll understand.
As usual, you have to be there to get it.
Yes, that's right.
Until we go there, I won't understand it.
Yes, until we go there, I won't understand it either.
That's enough. I don't like long stories. Anyway, I guess we need to find this entrance stone thing.
That is correct, Nakata said.
So where is it?
Nakata has no idea.
Like I had to ask, Hoshino said, shaking his head.
25. I fall asleep for a short time. Wake up. Fall asleep again. Wake up over and over. I don't want to miss the moment she appears. But I do miss it. I look up, and she's already sitting at the desk, just like last night. The clock next to my bed shows a little past 3. I'm positive I close the curtains before going to bed, but again, they're wide open. But there's no moon tonight. That's the only difference. There's a heavy cloud cover, and it might be drizzling outside. The room's much darker than last night, with only distant lamps in the garden casting a faint light between the trees. It takes a while for my eyes to adjust. The girl is at the desk, her head in her hands, gazing at the painting. She's wearing the same clothes as last night. Even if I squint and look hard this time, it's too dark to make out her face. Strangely enough, though, her body and silhouette stand out, floating there clearly in the darkness. The girl is Miss Sayaki when she was young. I have absolutely no doubt about it. She looks deep in thought, or in the midst of a long, deep dream. Hang on. Maybe she herself is Miss Sayaki's long, deep dream. At any rate, I try to breathe very quietly so as not to disturb the balance of this scene before me. I don't move an inch, just glance occasionally at the clock to check the time. Time passes slowly, steadily. Out of the blue, my heart starts beating hard, a dry sound as if someone's knocking at the door. The sound echoes through the silent dead-of-night room, and startles me so much that I nearly leap right out of bed. The girl's black silhouette moves ever so slightly. She looks up and listens in the dark. She's heard it, the sound of my heart. She tilts her head just a fraction, for all the world like an animal in the woods focusing on an unexpected, unknown sound. Then she turns to face me in bed. I don't register in her eyes, though, I can tell. I'm not in her dream. She and I are in two separate worlds, divided by an invisible border. Just as quickly as it came on, my pounding heart settles back down to normal. And so does my breathing. I'm back to being invisible, and she's no longer listening. Her gaze falls back on Kafka on the shore. Head in hands as before, her heart is drawn once more towards the boy in that summer scene. She's there for about 20 minutes, then vanishes. Just like last night, she stands up, barefoot, noiselessly glides towards the door, and without opening it, disappears beyond it. I sit still for a while, then finally get up. Keeping the light off, I go over in the darkness and sit down on the seat she just occupied. I rest both hands on the desk and absorb the afterglow of her presence. I close my eyes, scooping up her shivering heart, letting it seep inside mine. I keep my eyes closed. There's one thing I discover the girl and I have in common. We're both in love with someone who's no longer of this world. A short time later, I fall into a restless sleep. My body needs rest, but my mind won't allow it. I swing like a pendulum, back and forth between the two. Later, though, I'm not even sure if it's light out or not. Birds begin making a racket in the garden, and their voices pull me completely awake. I tug on jeans and pull a long-sleeved shirt over my t-shirt and go outside. It's after 5 o'clock and nobody else is up. I walk out of the old-looking town through the pine forest, set up as a windbreak, past the sea wall and onto the beach. There's barely a breeze against my skin. The sky is covered with a layer of grey clouds, but it doesn't look as if it's going to rain any time soon. It's a quiet, still morning. Like a layer of soundproofing, the clouds absorb every sound the earth sends up. I walk for a while on a path that runs parallel to the sea, picturing the boy in the painting walking the same path, canvas chair in hand, sitting on the shore. I'm not sure, though, what scene along this shore the painting depicts. The painting only shows the beach, the horizon, sky and clouds, and an island. Yet there are a number of islands along the shore, and I can't recall exactly what the one in the painting looked like. I sit on the sand, face the sea, and make a kind of picture frame with my hands. I imagine the boy sitting there. A single white seagull flits aimlessly across the windless sky. Small waves break against the shore at regular intervals, leaving behind a gentle curve
and tiny bubbles on the sand. All of a sudden I realize I'm jealous of the boy in the painting. "You're jealous of the boy in the painting," the boy called Crow whispers in my ear. "You're jealous of that pitiful 20-year-old boy, mistaken for someone else and pointlessly murdered. What is it, 30 years ago? So insanely jealous it hurts. This is the first time you've ever been jealous in your life. Now you finally understand what it feels like. It's like a brush fire torching your heart. You've never, ever in your life envied anybody else or ever wanted to be someone else. But right now, you do. You want more than anything to be that boy. Even knowing that at the age of 20 he was going to be smashed over the head with an iron pipe and beaten to death, you'd still change places with him. You'd do it to be able to love Miss Sayaki for those 5 years. And to have her love you with all her heart. To hold her as much as you want. To make love to her over and over. Let your fingers run over every single part of her body. And let her do the same to you. And after you die, your love will become a story etched forever in her heart. Every single night, she'll love you in her memory. Yup. You're in a strange position, all right. You're in love with a girl who is no more, jealous of a boy who's gone forever. Even so, this emotion you're feeling is more real and more intensely painful than anything you've ever felt before. And there's no way out. No possibility of finding an escape. You've wandered into a labyrinth of time, and the biggest problem of all is that you have no desire at all to get out. Am I right? Oshima comes in a little later than yesterday. Before he does, I vacuum the ground and first floors, wipe down all the desks and chairs, open the windows and clean them, scrub down the toilet, throw out the rubbish, pour fresh water into the vases. Then I turn on all the lights and switch on the catalogue computers. All that's left is to open the front gate. Oshima checks my work and gives a satisfied nod. "You learn pretty quickly, and don't mess around, do you?" I boil some water and make him some coffee. Like yesterday, I have a cup of Earl Grey. It started raining outside pretty heavily. You can hear thunder away in the distance. It's not yet noon, but it's like evening, it's so dark. "Oshima, I have something I'd like you to do for me." "What's that?" "Can you get hold of the sheet music for Kafka on the Shore somewhere?" Oshima thinks it over. "As long as it's on a music publisher's website, I imagine you could download it for a fee. I'll check it out and let you know." "Thanks." He sits at a corner of the counter, puts the tiniest lump of sugar into his coffee, then carefully stirs it with a spoon. "So you like the song?" "Yeah, a lot." "I'm fond of it myself. It's a lovely tune, quite unique. Simple, yet deep. It tells you a lot about the person who composed it." "The lyrics, though, are pretty symbolic," I venture. "From time immemorial, symbolism and poetry have been inseparable, like a pirate and his rum." "Do you think Miss Sayaki knew what all the lyrics mean?" Oshima looks up, listening to the thunder as if calculating how far away it is. He turns to me and shakes his head. "Not necessarily. Symbolism and meaning are two separate things. I think she found the right words by bypassing procedures like meaning and logic. She captured words in a dream, like delicately catching hold of a butterfly's wings as it flutters around. Artists are those who can evade the verbose." "So you're saying Miss Sayaki maybe found those words in some other space, like in dreams?" "Most great poetry is like that. If the words can't create a prophetic tunnel connecting them to the reader, then the whole thing no longer functions as a poem." "But plenty of poems only pretend to do that." "Right. It's a kind of trick,
And as long as you know that, it isn't hard. So long as you use some symbolic-sounding words, the whole thing looks like a poem of sorts. In Kafka on the Shore, I feel something urgent and serious. Me too, Oshima says.